My guest tonight is a man of many parts. He is a renowned medical doctor and researcher into the area of asbestos-related cancer, mesothelioma, asthma. He's also a co-founder of the Fathering Project that's based here at UWA. He spent time in Indonesia working with victims of the 2004 tsunami and is still involved in training trainers over there. He's also been the 2013 West Australian of the Year. Please welcome Dr. Bruce Robinson. So you're probably best known, I guess, around UWA for your work in cancer research and asthma. Tell us, what is an average day look like for you at work?
Yeah, so a typical day, I'd get up, always talk to my wife, have a coffee. I never go to work too early. And then we usually have a lab meeting where we discuss the latest research in the lab. And I've got to say, so we've got 32 people working in our lab, so there's always something happening. And right at the moment, our research is about as exciting as it can be. So I always get a skip in my step from that. I mean, it's great to be punching through the envelope of knowledge. I might have to see a few patients. Had a few patients to see today, because I'm a lung specialist. Might have a radio call or something like that, media stuff. I've done a fair bit of that. Today I had a couple of medical students who I was actually examining, like part of a test. But one of them, this is an example of what you do, one of them was getting a bit disillusioned by medicine, so I was able to sit there and talk to her about medicine, you know, how to live life in medicine, how to follow your heart and do the things that really are what you want to do rather than being told what to do. It's quite poignant, actually, because, you know, you can really influence a young student's life just in one conversation. Yeah, and I do various leadership sort of stuff. And then probably usually a few more lab meetings discussing our research. We're about to start a clinical trial, a world first clinical trial. And just to give you the one sentence summary, given that all cancers are caused by mutations in your DNA, a simple idea is to force the immune system to see and attack those mutations, because they should look foreign to the body like a virus, right? That's what we're doing.
Right.
Doesn't that sound really easy? It sounds obvious and easy, but boy, it's hard. And so, you know, this is world first stuff, so you can see why it's very exciting.
Yeah. So you're obviously passionate about medicine and research. If you think back to your days as a young student, maybe as a high school student, what got you interested in medicine in the first place?
So, as a high school student, I was interested in football and chasing girls. So I'm a real sort of Bogan type young bloke. Grew up in a Bogan area, Bassendean. I actually told someone the other day that when I was a kid, growing up in Bassendean, so my dad worked in a factory, etc., I used to go and sit up on the roof of my parents' house and look at the stars, and I used to like try to work out the mathematics of the universe and all that sort of stuff. But you wouldn't tell anyone in Bassendean you were doing that, so. And I said to this mate of mine that I was trying to work out the mathematics of infinity in space and time, because I said the whole notion of an expanded universe and the Big Bang hadn't reached Bassendean by then. He said, the only Big Bangs in Bassendean were the sound of the stolen Holden Kingswood's backfire, which is about right. So I didn't have very sophisticated ideas as a high school student other than playing footy. So, and just to really reduce your opinion of me even further, I tell you why I chose medicine. I'm in year 12 and I'm actually going to do physics. That's what I love, physics and mathematics. But I switched to doing medicine for a very deep philosophical reason. I needed a break from my study, so I went in and watched an episode of Dr. Kildare, which is a TV show back then, with my parents. And I saw all the pretty nurses, and I saw the way they looked at him, and I figured, oh, medicine's got to be better than nuclear physics. See how shallow I was? You asked the question, I'm just being honest.
Oh, I appreciate your honesty.
But I'll tell you one thing, though. I reckon I might have had a deep sense of medicine because my dad was like a medic in the Navy in the Second okay. World War. And we had these books around at home, and he never, ever leaned on me to do anything in particular. It was always my own choice. And I'll tell you a cute story about my dad. And I tell the medical students this about research because so I have a little trick. I show medical students a picture of some soldiers in the Second World War, some classic battle like Dakota Track or Ratchet to Brook or something, and you know, some wounded guys, and they say, what antibiotic are you going to choose? And they tell me, you know, whatever they're going to choose, flucloxacillin, probably a staph, whatever.
Yeah.
And I remind them that there was no penicillin. And I tell them that penicillin was only available to Australian troops in October 1944. And the reason I know that, and I read them a letter which says, Dear Mum and Dad, I'm using a new drug called penicillin. I'm the only one allowed to administer it in a hospital. And I say, that was written by my dad, October 1944. So I think it might have been in my blood, actually, that kind of notion of medicine.
Right. Yeah, my grandfather was a medic in Tobruk in the Second World War. Yeah.
Tough gig.
Very tough gig. Yeah, it was interesting talking to him later in life. He never talked about the war. When we were around as grandkids. It was only later in life in the nursing home that he started to talk about it. And I remember him saying, isn't it terrible? You spend all your life trying to forget these things and now you get to my age and you can't remember anything else.
Yeah. You know, I reckon, I look after a lot of the veterans and I realise something about why they don't talk about it. Part of it is they want to forget, but part of it is this. It's really important when you talk to someone who's been through really tough times. It's very scary to get an inappropriate response. And this is why I reckon, like, my dad used to drink a lot, and he was in the RSL, and they all just drank together, because they all understood. It's like police. Police, can you imagine having to go to some car accident or bus, you know, like six dead kids in the bus? This is not a thing you're going to just be able to talk to anyone about. And I had a bit of a sense of that. I went up to, as you said, up to Aceh after the tsunami. I actually went up five times. But the first time was soon afterwards. And it's really emotionally brutal. You know, there's bodies. Most of them have been cleaned up by the time I got there. There's just sadness. Sadness after sadness. And it's really brutal. And it's pretty rough living and what have you. And I got home. And I went to work on the Monday morning. And bless her, she didn't know any better. She said to me, oh, good to see you back, Bruce. Did you have a good time in Aceh? And I'm like wounded, which is what happens to anyone in those situations. And I thought, you know, that's just like, bless her. So I just smiled and said, oh, it was pretty interesting and moved on, right? That's why these guys don't talk about the war, because no one gets it.
So in your life, I guess particularly your professional life, I guess you've seen a lot of death and dying, working as a lung specialist. I guess most of the patients that you're meeting, they're generally not on track for recovery, are they?
Well, I have different sorts of... Yeah, well, the answer is I have seen a lot of people dying. Of course, I didn't get the young asthmatics. You know, I used to look after the West Coast Eagles that had asthma, and they'd walk in and sort of blow the machine off the scale. Anyone in the waiting room wants to get the autograph. The commonest lethal cancer is lung cancer. So I've got to break that sort of bad news to people all the time and do the journey with them. And it's been very much a part of my life, yeah.
So you see people, I guess, in a pretty raw state, when the emotions are pretty raw, they've just discovered they're going to die soon. What have you found out, what have you discovered about people when you see people that close to death, looking it in the face?
Oh, a lot, probably. You know, I actually... sometimes I tell a patient they're going to die, and they say to me, this is really sweet of them. They say, and I cry and everything, and then they say, oh, Bruce, this has got to be hard for you, because, like, we're just one of your patients, but when they say we are one of your patients, always a couple. But you've got to do this all the time. How hard it must be for you. That's sweet. And I say to them, look, it's probably the most intimate moment you can have as a doctor with a patient. To tell them that they're going to die. I mean, imagine if it was you, or someone you love, and you're sitting there. So you can do it really badly as a doctor and hurt them badly, make them bitter. But you can do it really nicely. And I'm not saying I'm great at it, but I'm probably okay because I've learned how to do it. And when you do it that way, you can really help them. The other thing is, you get quite comfortable doing it. I'll tell you what happened to me in the supermarket last year. Here's an example of how comfortable you get. I walked in the supermarket and there's Bob. Bob used to be the president of the PMC when my kids were at the primary school. That's 10 years ago. And I said, oh, Bob, nice to see you again. He's talking to this lady in her 30s. She said, oh, this is Mary, whatever her name is. She's got three kids at the school. I said, oh, great, love the school. And then she walked off and he said, she's dying of cancer. I'm thinking three primary school kids, this is a disaster. Anyway, whatever. So I go shopping, and you know, you go to the end of the row when you're shopping, end of the supermarket thing, and then you turn the corner. Anyway, there she was, ooh, right there. So I said, oh, Mary, nice to meet you again, and all the best. And by the way, Bob said you weren't well, so I just want to wish you all the best. And she said, yeah, I've got cancer, I'm dying. So she invited me in, if you like. Anyway, then I start talking to her about how is she going to tell the kids? Has she told the kids? How's she going in terms of things like, now this is where it gets really intimate, writing letters for the kids for them to open on their 16th birthday, making a video about her dreams and aspirations for them, how special they are. What about her husband? How's he going with it all? And I'm thinking, I met her 5 minutes ago, I've never met her in my life, and now I'm having the most intimate conversation you can have with a mother, which is about writing letters to their kids because she's not going to see them grow up. That's one of the great advantages of this. But yeah, some people die pretty well, actually, and some people cling with white knuckles to life.
What does dying well look like?
I think, well, just take that woman, for example. If she... I'll tell you what dying badly looks like. Lying to everybody. Pretending it's all going to be okay. Lying to self. Getting bitter with everybody. It's someone's fault. It's the government's fault. It's the fault of the school. It's the fault of someone who made you breathe in something, cigarette manufacturers, or someone who didn't give you suntan lotion and got melanoma, or God, or somebody, it's somebody's fault. And I've seen people die really badly. Well, maybe I'll tell you another true story, just to give you an example. I had a lady whom I saw who was dying, and I went to see her. No, she came to my office, that's right, for a follow-up. She said, Bruce, I want to die now. I said, oh, are you in pain? She said, no. She said, my husband, he can't handle the fact that I'm dying, so he's become angry. My son, he can't stand my husband's anger, so he's moved in with his girlfriend because he gets a lot of sympathy there. And now my husband thinks he's living in sin and he's abandoned the family. And my daughter, you know, she doesn't live at home. She's a hairdresser. She's got her own business. And she comes home and has a cup of tea and expects me to cook for her, which I'm happy to do. But my husband thinks she should cook for me. And she never mentions my cancer at all. How callous is that? She says, I want to die. didn't actually say, can you give me something, but anyway, I kid you not, I went for a haircut the next week and this girl was cutting my hair and I couldn't help but overhear her conversation. I thought, my goodness, I think this could be the daughter. And then, I'm a bit shy, so I thought, well, you can't really talk about your mother dying in the middle of a hairdressing salon. Then I thought, well, she wants to die, right, so can't get any worse than that. I have a moral obligation. So I said to her, ask you a question, you're not so-and-so's daughter, are you? She said, yes, I am, I know you're her doctor. That I realised then she was too afraid to just jump in and talk to me. Anyway, long story, I got the cancer counsellors into the family. They all held hands and cried and began to talk about it. He moved home. And I saw the mother in the hospice and she told me about everything had gone well. It turned from being really bad to really good, and her daughter used to come every week and do her hair in the hospice. So, you know, that's dying badly to dying well. Writing letters for your kids and exiting with some dignity. And honestly, grief is about the people left behind. So it takes a lot of courage to write letters to your kids, because then you've got to confront the truth that you're not going to see them walk down the aisle. If you're a man, you're not going to, you know, take your daughter down the aisle and hand her over, you know, all those things that are important for a dad. It takes a lot of courage, and my job as a doctor is to help them do that. And you become very close and very intimate with patients when you do that. And I don't know, as a Christian person, I think it's the most compassionate thing you can do.
Yeah. You say on your website that it was seeing people approaching the end of their life filled with regrets that really provoked you to start thinking about the fathering project. That's right? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I had already been pondering a bit because I teach medical students and their parents are often too busy to spend time with them. But yeah, I mean, because I have these close conversations with patients, the men would often say, if I had my life all over again, I'd spend more time with my kids. But probably everyone says that, so. But then the phrase that really got me to write a book, actually, was they said, I wish someone had told me when I was young what was really important. But there was no one to tell me, so I got sucked into work and all that stuff. I wish someone had told me. So I wrote a book about busy dads called Fathering from the Fast Lane, just really to get it off my chest. I honestly thought one person might buy. That would probably be my wife. You know, it became a bestseller, so people assumed that I knew what I was talking about, so they started asking me to speak, and then we got some grants to try to make the world a better place, and that's turned into the Fathering Project and 6 books and DVDs and a whole team of people now who do stuff. One of the most meaningful things I do, I mean, and I bet in this room there'll be a mixture of, you know, how good you reckon your dad was, if you had a dad who was in your life. But now, the Fathering Project, interestingly, it is not about fathers. People say, oh, isn't it great that you're helping dads? We say, that's not our target group. Our target group is helping kids. But statistically, the most powerful force in your life to determine your likelihood of, like, becoming a drug addict or getting into crime or having a bad attitude to school and teachers and bullying and da-da-da-da and certain issues of self-esteem, they come from your dad. Or a strong father figure, like a grandfather or good teacher or somebody, sports coach or something. So it's about the kids, changing the future of our children. I mean, if every kid in the country had a father figure speaking into their lives who was a really appropriate, strong father figure, you know, doing the things, like we say, take your kids out on a one-on-one date all the time. How many of you guys, and I'm sure some of you have, regularly gone out one-on-one with your dad, like for a coffee or something? That's not a yes. Interesting, they say both girls, yeah. Did your dad ever take you out for the father-daughter sex talk? take that as a no.
Spiritual intimacy.
Yeah, no, I've asked like 5,000 dads in live audiences who've ever taken your, who's got a daughter? Oh, hands got it, pretty much. And who's ever taken your daughter out for the father-daughter sex talk? And there'd only ever be about one or none in the room. It's a pretty interesting moment when you've got a couple hundred dads in a room.
Yeah.
Anyway, fathering project, one of the most meaningful things I do.
So has working in the fathering project, writing books on fathering, that kind of thing, has it made you reflect on the relationship you had with your dad much?
Yeah, to some extent. Made me learn about how to be a better dad for my kids. But yeah, my own dad. So my dad was a curious mixture. On the one hand, he was a chain-smoking, heavy-drinking guy that had a lot of problems. And on the other hand, he was pretty much a dad who was ahead of his time because, for example, he took us out camping and we'd get up in the morning and go swimming and he gave me the birds and the bees talk. Pretty embarrassing, actually, but anyway, he sat me down and a piece of paper and, you know, you don't know where to look, really, but... But let me give an example of my dad. There was a guy who lived two doors down. He was 2 years older than me and he sort of got in a bit of trouble. He didn't have a dad. And he was a classic sort of guy who's going to go nowhere. He got into trouble at school and whatever. You know, my dad scooped him up and became his father figure. And he used to bring Neil with us to the footy and camping. And this guy became like my older brother. And he sort of taught me the ways of the world, to be honest. Didn't have an older brother and Neil was a bit rough. But my dad became like his dad and made a complete difference. So I rang him. He lives in Melbourne. And he said that my dad had such an influence on him that he decided that there's a better way to live. And then he became a teacher and started to teach other people that there's a better way to live. You choose how you're going to live. And you don't have to, just because you don't have a dad, be a dropkick.
Was your dad a Christian man?
No.
No.
So my parents weren't churchgoers, no.
Where did you first start getting interested in Jesus?
Well, when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, all kids had exposure to religion, not like today. So everyone either went to Sunday school, they all had religious classes at school, you had to go, unless you really had a big excuse. So, you know, I had that God consciousness as a kid, like most people. But I can tell you the critical thing, it's interesting asking me this question at the University of Western Australia. Actually, I remember in first year, sitting in this... Now, where was I sitting? Over there somewhere, having lunch. Maybe I was in there. No, that's just the server, isn't it? No, I think I was sitting over there, and there were four of us having lunch from first year met, and one of the guys left, said, I've got to go. I said, where are you going? I'm going to the Christian Union, or Scripture Union, well, it's called something else then.
Evangelical Union.
Evangelical Union, that's right. And so we all laughed at it. But here's the thing. By second year medicine, you start to learn about the human body. And I study the human body in detail. You know, we're sequencing DNA and looking at, you know, all sorts of things every day. And I understand 1,000 times more the complexity of the human body than I learned in second year medicine. But it is hard to study the human body and not be, at least to hold it in awe and wonder. The same awe and wonder that I felt about the universe when I sat on my parents' roof, listening to the Holden Kingswood background. The same awe and wonder, and I still have that awe and wonder. So, just through circumstances, I sort of got challenged. You either, you know, you're going to have a go at this, Christianity, you're going to jump or not. That's the sort of challenge I had, because I've had a God consciousness, like I said. But from my friend's point of view, I was living the life of a normal young Bassanine boy, you know. So was I going to jump or not? And I remember, in a sense, shaking my fist at God and saying, look, if I jump, you better not let me down. Because this is going to cost me out there in the bogan world of Bassanine.
Yeah.
Never regretted it.
Yeah,
that's a long time ago now. I was 19. So, but anyway, my point is, it was science and the analysis of the awe and wonder of the human body, and thinking, surely this is not an accident, that got me over the line.
So you didn't find a conflict between science and Christianity at all?
No, in fact, I think there's less conflict. I don't think there's any conflict particularly. I think people imagine conflict where it doesn't exist. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's strengthened my faith, my heavy involvement in science.
Talk to us about that. In what ways? Just the wonder of the human body?
Well, I think human existence or the existence of the universe is in itself. I mean, you've got to find another explanation for it. So you might think it's a quantum fluctuation, and you might think of all sorts of ways of thinking about the existence of the universe, but no, each of them requires a lot of imagination. But the notion that God might be a creator is, it's hard to escape. And if you know about physics, anyone here studied physics? Yeah, so if you know about the anthropic principle, then you either have to have some kind of multiverse view of life, you either have to have an infinite view, which is obviously not correct, or a multiverse view, or it does look, that's a secular concept, the anthropic principle. For people who aren't familiar with it, it's that it takes, everything has to be perfect for humans to exist. If there's a multiple repeating universe, etc., parallel universes, then that is a ridiculous notion because eventually it's going to happen. But if it's not, then it does worry people because it does look perfect. So, for example, just pick one thing. If gravity was changed by a few billionths of a factor, so if you just had a few grains of sand in your hand and that increased your weight, or your mass, if you like, then the universe couldn't exist. Too much gravity and then just big crunch, too little and it all just, atoms just, molecules don't form. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, there's a whole bunch of science which is hard to explain otherwise. It doesn't mean that Christianity is true. There is always another way of looking at it. And a lot of scientists choose another way of looking at it. But in my view, it makes it reasonable. It's a reasonable view to take, that Christianity is true when you look at science.
So what convinced you to take that view?
So why did I finally jump? I think given the awe and wonder feeling, I think I felt like you had to be in or out, really. That's what I figured. So I was quite attracted to it because, I think Christianity is pretty attractive. When you know Christians, they're pretty proper Christians. I mean, they've often just got a particular character about it. I can't remember the details, but I just thought it was pretty attractive. But I think I'm someone who doesn't... I don't want to be ostracised by my footy mates, etc. People... Like I said, I used to laugh at that guy that left the table over there. So that's the sort of world I grew up in, so... But I thought there was something inherently weak about not choosing. So you had to choose whether you're in or out. So that's really, it was that sense that I needed to choose. It's kind of interesting. I didn't have anyone probably who put me off either. Wow. Or any life events that put me off. I mean, I always think, there's a probably exit signs here. I think science, so wherever you are in life, there are entrance and exit signs. And for a lot of people who, let's say, grew up in a Christian home, they read all this stuff, Dawkins, etc., and they see the exit word and they leave through the exit door. For me, who's not from that sort of background, for me it had the entrance sign on. And I think if you really are honest about it, well, you can choose either, but I think an entrance is a perfectly valid way. To be honest, my observation of scientists, that like half the scientists, almost half of scientists, believe in God. And I'm talking card-carrying physicists and, the senior scientists in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a ridiculous notion. But I think there are often other reasons why people... go through the exit door, and they're not actually intellectual reasons. And here's my example of this. I wish I'd lived next to Charles Darwin. I did a pilgrimage to Shrewsbury, where he grew up, because 200 years ago, Charles Darwin grew up as a kid in Shrewsbury at exactly the same time in exactly the same town as my great-great-great-great-grandfather. And who knows whether they ever met. Small town, probably did, whatever, but doesn't matter. And my great-great-great-grandfather came out to the Swanwick colony, and, you know, and here I am. And Charles Darwin went off and went to medical school, hated it, and preferred the bugs and the leaves and the trees, and jumped onto the beagle, and the rest is history. But he actually believed in God. But when he was, when his daughter Annie was 10, she got probably tuberculosis, but not clear from the record what she got. And they went off to a spa so to get her ready, and he just adored his daughter. And as someone who's got a daughter who he adores, I absolutely appreciate how he felt. And he was beside himself when she was sick. And she died. And it absolutely gut-wrenched him. And he lost his faith soon after that. I think that's what happens to people. There's something more emotional and visceral than intellectual. And you know, that's why I'd like to have lived next to Charles Darwin. And we've already talked about people dying. I would have gone over every night with a bottle of whiskey and talked to him. I mean, I'm not saying he wouldn't have still been angry and sad and dumped the whole idea of God. It's just that, I don't know, I just think, my observation is that people go through the exit door for reasons other than intellectual reasons.
Yeah, it's personal hurt, pain.
Personal hurt, or you know, someone's in love with a non-Christian, wants to sleep with them, and they don't want to get, you know, just stop going to church because no one says anything, but they sort of judge themselves, look in the mirror. I've seen all sorts of things.
Yeah,
I'm not judging them, you know, but I just think if you stand back and say, why do you believe what you believe? You often don't get a well thought out answer. I mean, someone says, I'm not a Christian because of the abusive priests. That's not an answer, because that's not a thought out answer. That's an emotional answer to something you've heard on the news. Unless you were personally abused. You know, if a person was personally abused, I can imagine that would be hard.
Let me change tack slightly for a moment.
You can ask me anything you like.
I'll take you back to 2004 for a moment.
Yeah.
December 26. I remember I was sitting on the couch watching the Boxing Day test, and there were the news ticker across the bottom kept talking about the tsunami that had hit Indonesia. And I don't think any of us quite realised how massive it was straight away. But pretty soon we were hearing about, you know, this was the third largest earthquake that's ever been recorded, 30 metre waves, whole villages getting wiped out, nearly 250,000 people killed. You saw that, you decided to go to Indonesia, to Aceh. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, like I heard 3,000 people had died, and then I was down south, actually at a beach mission, and I turned the radio on and it got to 60,000 people, and I thought that was pretty bad. And then the ABC reporter came on and talked about all these kids who'd become orphans because they could swim but none of their parents or grandparents or anyone could. So when the water went down, they found they had nobody. Not a single person from their family remained because they all live in the same fishing village. I wept. And I have a tropical medicine and public health qualification. And when you think about it, like I was down at the beach down south, and if you looked over the ocean, if the ocean wasn't curved, you could actually see Aceh. Because the coast of Sumatra is a direct line, right? So I thought, love your neighbour. I'm going. So I ended up in a team of Indonesians. There was one big tall white guy and 120 Indonesians. So I had to learn Indonesian. That's something else I had to do. And we were really working at the coalface. I mean, working in tents, sleeping in tents and what have you. And some places were really hot. It's quite... hard to describe. So there was one place that was stinking hot. I was actually doing this clinic in this tent, and it felt like I was doing the clinic in an oven. It was so hot. It was just sweat pouring off me. And I went down, at the end of the day, I went down to where the ocean was coming in. And there was no beach or anything, and of course you've got long pants on because it's a fundamentalist Muslim region. Can't have shorts. Anyway, the waves were breaking on this petrified coral. It was really rough. But because, you know, being a West Australian, used to, you know, waves and everything, so I thought, I'm getting into that water. So I waited till the waves broke, and then when one wave, it sort of, I jumped in and sucked me out and had a good swim. But it was kind of eerie, because right underneath me was where the school had been. So the wave had come in and just ripped the shoreline, including the school and the kids and everything. And it was right underneath me, so I didn't dive down or anything. I couldn't have done it then. And then I thought, gee, out of all those thousands of people just got pushed out to sea past me. It's really eerie. It's a really eerie and awful feeling. And, you know, we'd have kids who, well, some of those orphan kids would come to our clinic. We used to give them what was called sisa sisa, which was leftovers. So we had to bring our food from to the tent from where the cook was cooking. Anyway, we gave them sisa sisa leftovers, but we didn't do that really. We were feeding them. We just had extra, which brought all the time. Mm-hmm. Parents who lost their kids, every single child and their wife, you know, just to talk to them, pretty sad. You know, kids who, one girl who had actually came to me with a bit of wheezing, and she had this scared look on her face. Anyway, the mother told me that the mother had gone to the market and left this 10-year-old in charge of her 6-year-old daughter, and the wave came in and she tried to reach out to grab her 6-year-old sister, sorry, the 10-year-old sister, her 6-year-old sister, but she just slipped out of her grasp and was never seen again. I mean, how can you deal with that as a 10-year-old? Anyway, the sadness was massive. And I'm not sure, you know, you just go and work and hope you've done some good.
Yeah, how do you cope when you're confronted with suffering like that?
Well, you do cry. You just shut your door at night and weep for the sadness that you've just experienced. Then you get up next morning and you go again. It's good to be in a team where you talk about things. And it's good to have a break. We used to have a break once a week and go down to the beach, have a swim.
Has it made you question your faith in God?
It's a curious thing about suffering. I'm often asked about it because I see it so much. And it is, you know, it is the great paradox of Christianity. Here's the paradox. God is not the author of suffering, but it happens. It happens to innocent people like kids on the coast of Aceh. How can this happen? And whilst there are theological explanations, I never give them. Because people who ask don't care about them. They care about these poor kids and often their own mother, grandmother, brother, sister, somebody who's suffered. And no theological explanation does anything except annoy them. But here's the paradox. When you go to Aceh, this incredibly visceral, hard task. And even as a Christian, you don't go there to convert people. This is Sharia law. You say one word, you'll be out and the whole team will be thrown out. So there is no opportunity for sharing anything if you're a Christian, right? So you don't go there to convert anyone. You go there because they need help. And here's the interesting paradox. Christians are disproportionately represented in these sort of groups. It is amazing. They're everywhere. If if suffering was such a challenge to faith, why are they there in the midst of it? I said to one guy, why are you here? Because this is a Christian guy. He said, oh, leading a Christian team. I said, Sharia law, you can't say anything, can't do anything. He said, yeah, of course. He said, we're just here to bring the love of Jesus to people who need it. I know, it's just a paradox, you know, like, yeah. Here you have this argument that there can't be a loving God, and here you have Christians who are showing the love of God at the coalface in the most hard, viscerally difficult, sad, weepy, bodies in the street kind of situation. First team into Aceh, day after the tsunami, was a Christian team who landed in a plane. And I worked with these guys for a while, and they just picked up they got brought the sick ones, the bodies got moved aside, and they got a garage, and they had patients with intravenous lines and in this garage. And the Indonesian lady who was running it, she said she'd work from 8 a.m. till about midnight, and then she'd fall into a heap and get up in the morning again. And she was there for about 6 months. And after a while, I said to her once, we were walking down the beach, I said, did you have any sort of break or whatever? No. Did you have anyone looking after you? She said, no. You just did it. And I said, it must have been awful. And she started to weep. I mean, she gave of herself. Anyway, there's this paradox. So didn't challenge my faith, no.
Yeah. With all your history, your research, your fathering project, the stuff in Aceh, I guess that's all been recognised with the 2013 West Australian of the Year. All those have kind of piled together into that. I wanted to ask you, how has that changed your life? What difference has it made?
You mean the awards?
Yeah, how's it affected life for you?
Oh, I've got a lot more requests. So, for example, this university asked me to do a lot of things as West Australian of the Year, and I was also West Australian Australian of the Year in the final of the thing. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So I did a lot of things for UWA and still do. I get asked to do a fair number of things. I was already doing a lot, but I get asked to do a lot more, probably media-type things. To be honest, I had to lie because I had a lot of interviews after that. This must be the biggest thing in your life, and this must be a great honour. And it was nice, you know, but yep. Honestly, I'm the sort of guy, I'd rather be home with my wife having a glass of wine and my kids having a barbecue and my friends and being at the footy. And I don't need external recognition, I think. So it was great, but not as great as people imagined.
Yeah.
It gave me more chances to speak at things, I guess. But I got an award this year at an international meeting. I wasn't even expecting it. Actually, I was half asleep leaning on the back of my chair at the back of the room when they called my name out, and I thought I wish you hadn't given it to me, because I'm kind of done with awards. Like, this sounds very arrogant, but I don't, can you give it to someone else, because I've got enough, really. So I must share them around, because starts to get embarrassing.
You get to move in some pretty exalted circles now. You're around people who are at the top of their field in various areas, whether it's politics or society or whatever. What have you discovered about people who are at the top of their game, the top of the tree?
Well, I've discovered what everyone else discovers, and that is that they're terribly ordinary. Ordinary in a nice way. They've just got the same fears that we all have. I was taught by a guy named John Anderson 16 years ago these things. It's lonely at the top, right? That's not a secret. But how do you deal with that loneliness? They don't have real friends, because everyone wants something from them. So I decided then and there, because I do mix in all those circles, to be a real friend to these people. And I have a set of rules. Here's my first rule. Never ask anyone, like a prime minister or a, you know, someone famous or whatever, wealthy, but never ask them for anything. And secondly, always talk to them about personal things. So, for example, I wouldn't ask a politician, even if they ask me what I might need, I say, no, I'm okay, thanks. But I'm always going to say, how are the kids? How are you going? And what happened, of course, is I've ended up quite close to all these people, so I have them, their personal numbers on my phone, which is why I'm a little bit careful about my phone, because if someone got it,
yeah,
they would get all these numbers of people, and it just wouldn't be fair.
Hmm.
Now, let me tell you exactly what I don't want to over-spiritualise this, but when I go to something where I'm going to sit with some of these people, I always pray, can I be Jesus to these people? Because the thing about Jesus is, he never paid attention to whether you were up there in society or down there. So often people who are up there in society look, not friendly, but they look down on the people down there. And people who are down there look down on the people who are up there. They've got some way of describing people who are up there. It's a tribal thing. You know, it's a tribal thing. But Jesus paid no attention. And when it comes to asking for things, I think of the rich young ruler that he met, right? He talks to him. And he could have been a bit schmoozy, and because the guy was rich, he could have thought, oh, we can get some money for the leprosy clinic or something. But he spoke to him directly, and then it says he was moved with compassion, which presumably meant he wept. He wept for this man. I mean, honestly, in life, who do you know who is actually moved with compassion for you? Your parents, probably. I don't know, it's just not that common. And so I always think, when I go to meet these people and spend time with them, which you're right, I do spend a lot of time with those sort of people, I want to be like Jesus, and I want them to know that I don't want anything from them, but that I am a genuine friend who cares for them. And, you know, they'll say that if they leave politics, they'll, you know, they say, I want to thank you because you were always there for me, and you, someone who didn't want something but cared about me and would ring me and look after me, etc.
You've written that it's sad and frustrating to hear from dying patients that they regret not having made decisions that would have enabled them to live a richer, fuller life. Do you feel like you've had a rich life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have a phrase which has become a little bit popular. I get asked about it, and I'll tell you what I actually told these medical students today. It's what I call the caramello life. Aren't you? Who's ever had a caramello chocolate? Put your hand up. Oh, you know what I'm talking about, okay. But here's the thing. Because I, in my clinic, when I talk to patients, it doesn't matter how rich and famous or whatever they are, they become essentially naked in my room because I see them as they really are. But here's the thing. I notice that they're often, their lives are like an Easter egg that looks like chocolate, but on the inside it's hollow, and they have hollow lives. But there are other people whose lives sort of look the same. They've got chocolate, but inside there's a rich golden core. And that rich golden core always comes from the same handful of things. It is about relationships, particularly with a partner and with children, and good friendships, serving the community, work that is fulfilling, and having that. It's actually quite hard to get, I think. So I think people can get a caramello life without being a Christian. I know some of them. I had dinner with one of my best friends on Sunday night, who's a complete atheist. He's a sort of Richard Dawkins anti-Christian. And he's rather fascinated by me, because I know more about science and cosmology than him. And he can't understand why I'm still a Christian, right? And he's rather fascinated by it. But in general, I find that caramello life, well, for me anyway, I had to be a Christian. I don't know what would have happened to me. The Bogan Bassendean boy, I would have got some girl pregnant and
still be chasing nurses.
Yeah, I'd be, I don't know. I'm probably, I think I'm, I'd probably be more selfish and probably more driven by things. I'm sure I would have been more driven by things that weren't noble. I'm not saying I'm noble now, but I've just met the most wonderful people who have inspired me that there's a better way to live. And I think, I just think, well, this is just me anyway, I just think God has softened my heart and given me a heart of compassion towards people. Like maybe all these important people, I'm sitting next to them at the test match, maybe I would have just taken the opportunity to ask them for something. I don't believe I would have been reaching out in compassion to them. So yeah, I think I've had a caramello life. I'm grateful to God because there's no other way I could have had that. I'm not saying that's a lay down argument for Christianity, but...
Yep. Well, that seems like a good note to finish on. Why don't we stop the interview there? But we might take the opportunity to open it up for questions. So, would anyone like to ask Professor Robinson a question?
I mean, professionally, I wonder. I imagine myself ending up in Houston, actually, because I was interested in physics, and of course, when I was a kid, it was all about space, and that's where the jobs were as well. And I was enthralled by all of that. I used to build space rockets, or design them anyway, in the back of my backyard. I don't know. Professionally, I imagine I could have done all sorts of things, really. It wouldn't have given me anything. I mean, I could have been just some boffin. I mean, you did physics and get in the lab and start measuring things. I mean, medicine has, in a sense, drawn me out of myself because, hey, you get to listen to patients and you learn about human beings and they become terribly interesting. I would have thought they were boring if I was a physicist, probably. I also think about how my life would have gone if at 19 I hadn't become a Christian. And you know, you never quite know, unless you've got a twin brother and you randomly allocate them to, you know. But sometimes I run into old girlfriends and I remember what I was like, and I don't know, I just think I could have made a catastrophe of my life, really. I really think I could have. I mean, well, anyone who's immature enough to choose their whole career based on Dr. Kildare TV show. You know, maybe I would never have matured. Maybe I would have only matured this much. Anyway, long ago. I'm certainly a better dad. Absolutely a better dad. Absolutely not. I pictured myself being a half-time hospital clinician and half-time in private practice. I did think about being a missionary doctor at one stage. I do love third world medicine. And like I said, I studied tropical diseases when I was in England. But I met my wife, Jackie, and she had actually grown up in Africa. And when I suggested that was on my mind, she said, you're going to have to do it on your own because she's not going back. She didn't mind it herself, but she said it was a terrible way to bring up kids. White kids out in the bush in someone else's continent. And she said she's not going to do it for her kids. So she suffered like a lot of kids do who end up in the colonial or missionary service. And so I honoured that, although obviously I've been able to go back now. Years later. That research is something I never thought I'd do. I had no interest in it. But I went to the United States to do a doctorate just to sort of get it out of the way, if you like. It was sort of the next thing. And I really took to it like a duck to water. And I think it does fit my kind of way of thinking. So, no, I've had lots of zigs and zags in my career that were unexpected, and I certainly would not have imagined myself doing the things I'm doing now. I mean, how boring would it be if your life was a railroad track and you just started there and came out the other end? Much more fun to be uncertain than...
In your experience, what do you think is the one quality a doctor should have? One quality.
So the one is... I mean, let's assume a certain level of competence. I presume you mean above that level of confidence, because that's pretty useful. It's easy to say compassion, but I would say communication. Because I think doctors have felt compassionate, but not communicated very well. Medical student of mine, she told me that her aunt was 38, breast cancer, big lump, went to the doctor. And the doctor felt so sorry for her, he said, "You stupid woman, how could you have let it get so big?" But hey, who here, I mean, put your hand up, if you can remember having said something to somebody and you wish you could take it back again. So communication, and that's like that lady in the supermarket. You know, once you learn, like the Bogan boy from Bassendean, when I went to medical school, I was in awe and wonder of how they could even talk to people. I mean, you know, you sit there and a patient cries, and you're like a goldfish. You know, what do you actually say? And now I feel much more, obviously, comfortable. And this applies to friends as well. So... you know, if someone has some problem, whatever, I feel much more comfortable sort of going right into their inner sanctum. So I think communication, and this is not a skill that comes out of the sky. I think some people have it, but most don't. So it's like many things in medicine or in any profession, an acquired skill. It has influenced me a lot, and I think it's very similar to the question about the rich and famous, the powerful people, which is, I sit there and I think, what would Jesus do to these people? And I think it's often when you're talking to a person who's dying, you know, you're pretty tired and busy and there's someone waiting and you've got to get back to the hospital or whatever. And one thing I'll say about if you spend another half an hour with patients talking about stuff, you do not get paid anymore. So it costs you money to do this, right? So in the end, this is what I say. Well, I just need to pick an example of Jesus. Jesus tells his followers that he's going to die a gruesome death, right? And then they start to walk down the road to the very place he's going to die. And you can just imagine pretty heavy hearts. And these blind guys called out saying, "Oh, Lord, Lord." Anyway, he walks over and says, "What do you want?" He says, obviously, what they want to be healed. And it says, and his followers try to say, "Oh, not now, you know. Like, master's a bit busy, like, going to be dying, so hasn't he done enough," kind of thing. And it says, doesn't just say that Jesus went over and responded, but it says he was moved with compassion. Again, probably tears or body language or something, but he was never so self-absorbed that he couldn't reach out in compassion. So that's what happens when I'm talking to someone who's dying. And sometimes I cry as well, especially if they're like my age, and if they've got kids of my age, etc. But, you know, I've had people in their 20s and 30s dying. I've got to break the news to people that age. And I just think, how can I be Jesus to these people? How can I? What's the most compassionate thing I can do? And what's the most helpful thing I can do? So I have, for example, a phrase which I use, and just imagine it was you. This is 100% winner. So if it was you, right? And I was going to tell you, I probably wouldn't say it the first time, but if you come back and see me in a week or something, I'd say, look, plan for the worst, hope for the best. So of course you're going to hope for the best, but you don't hope irrationally. Plan for the worst. What does that mean? And I mentioned before about writing letters to the kids. Take your wife on a trip to Paris, wherever she wants to go, where you want to go. Do it now. But can you imagine if you've got three kids and you're never going to see them grow up? Can you imagine what it'd be like writing a letter to them? So I say, your tears will fall on the page. And you'll keep pushing it aside. But it's the most confronting thing you can do. So they do it, and they are so grateful. Because when they do it, so it's easy to imagine that you're not going to die, especially if you're still well. But once you sort of, it's like breaking the barrier of truth. And from then on, every day becomes a gift. The sky is blue. Never noticed how blue the sky was. See, look at the leaves of the tree. They're really green. I've never noticed how green they are. And every day becomes a gift. So that is my act of compassion, to give them that sort of thing, and to go beyond myself to do that, and that is directly the model of Jesus on that road. Plus, I think a softness in my heart that I probably wouldn't have had otherwise, to be honest. You're all pretty young, but I mean, now's the time to think about it. There'd be two things I reckon that are generically true about this. One is to understand what the word balance means. So, balance. So the things that I mentioned that make a Caramello life, like for me, right, is my wife, my three kids, and two grandkids now, good friends who care about me and vice versa, not just acquaintances. Serving the community and the Fathering Project and Arche is an example of that. My work, and also myself. You know, getting fitness and just the vibrancy of personal inner life. So that's six things that make up, let's say, Caramello life, right? And you have to understand those six, because one of them will never do it for you. Some people are obsessed with their children. They talk about them non-stop. It's their whole life. That is never enough for a balanced life. Or they're obsessed with their partner, or their friends, or their work, or their community service, or themselves. It has to be a balance of all of them. So to get it clear in your mind what that balance is actually really important. And what I do is I actually work my way around. It's in my head of the pie chart. I work my way around. So if I get to friends, for example, and I haven't really caught up with my good friends for a while, I'm likely to phone them up. Or if it gets to my kids, I think, gee, I haven't really, because they're married, I mean, I think about them. I actually have a routine where 6 days a week I pray for them, you know, for those groups, one after the other. So Monday I pray for my wife. It's all I pray for. And I thank God for her and all her, you know, her way of being and her faith and her body that she's given to me, and the body that's given me my beautiful kids, and I pray for her, is she not well at the moment, etc. So it's a really important thing to understand balance. And secondly, it's really important to be intentional about getting it. Like I said, go around that pie chart and say, you get the friend and you think, gee, who's a really good friend? Who's been a good friend to me that is going to care about me? And what about people I should be caring about? Is there anyone I should be moved with compassion for? Is someone struggling at the moment? And don't take no for an answer. Don't use stupid phrases like, if there's anything I can do. Rock up and do it. What a friend of mine said to me once, Bruce, you're looking a bit down. you know, I said typical Aussie footballer. Yeah, they're right, mate. No, I'm not taking no for an answer. I'm coming round with a bottle of wine tonight and I want to know what's going on. I'm not taking no for an answer. That's a friend. That's compassion, that's a friend, and so ask, what can you do? And that's intentionality. Yeah, good bunch, lots of good questions.
Are there ways you can share that Jesus in your
fear? It's very uncommon for me to talk about my faith to patients. So, for example, it's inappropriate most of the time when they're dying to barge in and talk about faith, although usually it comes up indirectly because you have to ask a patient what sort of support they've got, kids or family or a community group such as a church group or whatever. I do talk about faith a lot with my scientist friends, and interestingly, I'll tell you something very interesting, they're always the ones who bring it up. This friend of mine, who I said has got a Caramello life, but he's a non-Christian. We went backpacking for a week, just the two of us. And every day he was into me about, you know, whatever, some sort of cosmological argument, or, you know, all the usual arguments. And we got back towards Perth, and as we drove through Armidale, or whatever it was down the freeway down there, I said, we've talked about Christianity a lot. He said, yeah, we have. But I said, I just want to remind you of something. I have not brought it up once. And he's just rather fascinated by it. But my view of Christianity is similar to St. Francis, which is preach the gospel and when necessary use words. For example, what I just said, if you are intentional in thinking about friends and you're moved with compassion for them and you say, I'm coming around to the bottom line, and I want to know what's going on, and, you know, I'm going to take a shot. Whatever it is, you know, in a Jesus-like way, guarantee they won't have many people like that. That is... So I think the world functions, and this is a bit to do with that people make decisions about faith on more visceral, emotional grounds than intellectual grounds. And we have a theory called moths and cockroaches. A moth is attracted to the light and a cockroach is repelled by it. And I think the way you live your life, no matter what you believe, you can't make people into whatever you believe, but you can turn them into moths or cockroaches. So, for example, my wife has a brother and sister who never darkened the door of a church. They were turned into cockroaches. They were repelled by what they saw. And I imagine, as we said before, that if you're a child in a school and you're abused by a priest or whatever, that you'll be pretty soon turned into a cockroach. Understandably. So when you say, how do you deal with people in my job or anything, it's always about trying to help people become moths. And the way to do that is not an intellectual argument, but being moved with compassion. I mean, for any non-Christian, if you look at the model of Jesus, it's pretty hard not to be attracted to it. I mean, we've already talked about what he did when he reached out in kindness to the blind people when he was about to be killed, you know, and a woman's caught in adultery, everyone wants to stone her, and he says he's going to cast the first stone. I mean, that is so non-judgmental. Hard not to be attracted to that. You know, and I'm a leader. And Jesus, you know, these guys wanted to be up there and leaders. He said, I'll show you how to be a leader. And he gets a towel and a basin of water and washes their feet. It's hard not to be attracted to those powerful images of how to live your life. So, yes, I think if Christians live like that, then it's hard not... Well, people can more likely become moths than cockroaches. That includes your own kids, by the way. I think, you know, sadly, for my wife's brother and sister, they became cockroaches, and that's their parents' responsibility mostly. It's another story, but it is something that's weighed heavily on my heart. And I know that when my kids were growing up, I can't tell them what to believe, because people make their own decisions. In fact, the more you tell them, the more they're going to rebel. But it did worry me. I didn't want to put them off. I didn't want to turn them into cockroaches like my brother and sister-in-law.
Is exactly the conversation I had with these students, or one of these students today. A disillusioned student. But I think medical students remain a little bit idealistic until they graduate. So when I talk to groups of students about working in the third world, and no matter how hard I say it is, they all line up afterwards. They want to volunteer. And I think students, probably you guys as well, there's something. I mean, I love medicine, but there is something a little bit hollow than just getting up in the morning and seeing patients one after the other and getting paid lots of money to do it. I mean, I like it, but it's not enough. So doctors have a terrible track record of getting sucked into things, you know. So a very poor marriage success rate. They're not people who have spent a lot of time with their kids, at least the males, much better now. They often don't have much of a personal life. They often don't have any friends. Medicine is a very lonely profession, particularly for males. And then they get sucked in by money, and they've got nothing else to live for, really. Because they can make lots of money, they do. And they have hollow lives, not caramello lives. So yeah, I think it happens mostly after they graduate. And then they get the age of 50 and say, how did I get sucked into this? That's why we tell them about the caramello life, so that they can be intentional from the moment they graduate. To not get sucked in and have a sad and disillusioned life. I mean, doctors have a high rate of alcoholism and suicide and depression and stuff, disillusionment. I mean, I'm curious to know what you're all studying. Just tell me quickly what you're studying.
Medical science and physics. Medical science and philosophy.
Yeah.
Physiology and pharmacology.
We forgot there.
Maths and medical science.
Podiatry.
Engineering.
Medical science.
Engineering physics.
I'm studying medical science. Engineering and pharmacology.
Yes.
So you could hand up for physics.
I still love physics.
Well, you'll all be confronted with the same issues in life that as many of the students are confronted with. I mean, probably everyone is bricklayers and people put in swimming pools. Caramello life is something you've got to fight for.
Last question.
So if there was one thing you could tell you of yourself heading to medical school right now, what would that be?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's more like one of those there but things. If I was going to medical school now at the age of 17 and a half, right back then, it would be, in a year and a half's time, you're going to be challenged about whether you are a weak person, or you're going to jump and become a Christian, or you're going to just be that weak sort of basso footy bogan bloke that you are, getting loved by the people around you and accepted. When that moment comes, in a year and a half's time, jump. Well, I did. You see, that's why I can say that, and I don't have main huge regrets about all sorts of things. I mean, I think that'd be the thing I'd say.
Actually, that's a very interesting phrase about jumping, and I'm actually just going to be. There's a phrase that's helped me for a long time, and it's about reason. And it's exactly what happened when I was 19, and it's exactly the answer to science, etc. And the phrase was, it arose 300 years ago from a guy in England, doesn't matter who, but here's the phrase. Faith can swim where reason can only wade. Faith can swim where reason can only wade. And I talk to my friends and they are wading and they are too afraid to take that plunge. I asked a friend of mine the other day, he said, oh, but you never know. Take the plunge, you're not standing on solid reason anymore, and you know, you never know what's going to happen. You get all these weirdo people who think weirdo things, and I said, that's exactly the problem. Faith can, reason can only weigh where faith can swim. Anyway, that's what I have experienced, and so I would tell my 7.5-year-old self to make sure you take that plunge.
All right. Okay. I'm just really interested to hear about the Fathering Project. And because obviously you said your dad wasn't a Christian, so you wouldn't have had like that Christian role model father figure in your life. So how did you get all this wealth of knowledge that you managed to bring into a book and turn into a course? And, yeah.
Good question. I have interviewed 400 people. So I have a trick, which is, well, of course, I've read all the published articles and read all the books, but they're often a bit boring. They say certain things, and then there's like 50 books, and they all say the same thing. So there's a law of diminishing returns. So I went and interviewed 400 people for an average of 2.5 hours each, which is 1,000 hours and 1,000,000 interview words. And I asked them about fathering. Sometimes they were dads, mostly, but I'd ask, like I wrote a book about daughters and their dads, so I asked lots of women about what's important about that a girl or a young woman needs from her dad. The point about that is that you get not only people's opinions, but road-tested ideas. You say, what's worked for you? Or what didn't work? So my books are basically full of ideas and, you know, quotes and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, and I wouldn't ever dare to extrapolate from my own life, including my own three kids, to how people should function. It's all about... So the Fathering Project is a UWA project. It's not a church project or anything. And it's entirely secular, but it is based on best practice, evidence-based recommendations. And that is why we are invited into every school that we ever go to. And our goal, which we're moving towards, is to... So we go to a school... And we talk to the dads about how important dads are. And then they form a thing called a champion dads group. So they meet regularly, and then they might have a father-child camp out in the school playground, or sausage sizzle, a few beers, or billy cart derby, or whatever. And then we're making DVDs all the time, which they will then show. So a few beers, and then they watch a DVD about how do you help your kids not do drugs, or what do daughters need from their dads, or how can you help the kids in their education, or what happens if, you know, or something. And that's sustainable. And the plan is to be in every school in Australia in 5 years. And if you imagine a school, right, even if half the kids have got no dad, the other half will have a dad. And that's to say, half of those dads aren't much good, right? So now you only got 25% of the dads are any good. But every kid in that school will end up engaging with that dad, because that dad will be at the sports day, or you go around to his house to play, or, you know, whatever. And we teach those dads how not just to be better dads, but father figures. So, like my friend Neil, talk about Neil and my dad, the dad would realise that he could be a better father figure to that kid who's got no dad. And he's going to scoop him up and take him camping and take him to the footy and speak into his life and say, you know, pick a moment and say, Neil, mate, I know things are a bit tough at home, but I've watched the way you do this and you're a winner, mate. I believe in you. You got a gift. And apparently that's all it takes. So can you imagine in Australia where every single kid has someone saying that into their lives? So that's what we do. And that's how we do it. We get best practice information from research and talking to people and all that stuff.
Bruce, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for...
I'm suddenly thinking, am I supposed to be somewhere? Whenever I don't look at my watch, I'm sort of waiting for my phone to ring when my PA says, you know, where am I and you're there. But obviously I've got my phone turned off. That's the other thing. No, but I'm not supposed to be anywhere, so... But just, you know, you are a fantastic bunch, honestly. The fact that you're even interested in these questions means that you're way ahead in terms of setting your life up for a Caramello life.
Well, thank you for giving us a glimpse of what it looks like to be a Caramello moth. Thank you for spending the time with us. Would you please thank Professor Robinson?